welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I cannot tell you how excited and overjoyed I am to be opening season two with our very first conversation with the absolutely incredible Leila F. Saad. And if you don't know, Leila F. Saad is author of Me and White Supremacy, and her contribution in the anti-racism space and the healing work that she is doing is just phenomenal. So it's a real honor to be able to steal a few moments with her. And it's going to be like you're eavesdropping on a conversation with friends. I will introduce her a bit more formally. Leila F. Saad is a New York Times and Sunday Times bestselling author, anti-racism educator, international speaker, and podcast host. Her podcast is called The Good Ancestor. And she talks about race, identity, leadership, and personal transformation and social change. And she's also currently working on her young readers edition of Me and White Supremacy, so more young people can engage in this work in a structured and meaningful way as well. And I've been aware of Leila's work for quite some time. A colleague of mine flagged her work with me because we were doing similar work at a similar time. And this space is quite small. It's there aren't many of us doing this work, so we tend to either know each other, or even if we don't know each other intimately, we support, because we also know what each other and one another has to endure to be able to withstand and do this work. So there is a deep love and respect for anti-racism educators across the board, Leila being one of them. And I remember being interested in it was an interesting moment for me just observing. So before her book, she did a digital Instagram challenge on Me and White Supremacy, which then morphed into a digital workbook, which she self-published in 2018. And that workbook was downloaded by over 100,000 people in the space of 6 months. And I remember just thinking, I just remember being filled with hope, because of course, acutely aware we live in a racist society. That was the first time I really was able to gauge how many people were actively wanting to engage in the work. Leila and I get to talk about all of that and more. We talk about belonging, parenting and racism. It's a masterclass on boundaries, so get your notebooks at the ready. And we talk about being anti-racist educators, and I invite Leila to share what it's like to be a New York Times bestselling author too. So I hope this conversation nourishes you as much as it did me, and I cannot wait to hear what you think. So let's dive on in.
Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. And I am delighted to be joined by incredible human, New York Times bestselling author and good ancestor, Leila F. Saad. Thank you so much for saying yes, Leila.
Thank you so much for inviting me. You know I love you. I love being in conversation with you.
This is going to be a love fest for the next hour or so. Before we get into it, I really want to ask you, how are you?
I think like many people, I'm taking things day to day. And it's interesting because we're recording this at almost the 1 year mark of going into lockdown, right?
Yeah.
So we were like last year, oh, you know, by April, May, we'll be, you know, back to normal. And here we are a year later, and some things have changed, but some things have really stayed the same. And some things which were so odd to us at the time have become completely normal. Right.
Yeah.
So wearing a mask and, you know, social distancing. For me as a parent, we are now doing alternate days of the kids being at school and the kids learning from home.
Mm.
And that's just something that we've had to adapt to, is being a parent who's also a teacher, right? Who's also a writer, who's also a podcaster, who's also all of these other things. And that just be a part of the day that, you know, stuff needs to get done. So I have found that the way for me to keep my sense of sanity is to take things day by day, which is hard. It's very hard, you know, because we want to make plans, we want to have these intentions, we want to get things done. And for me, you know, part of being a good ancestor is living with a great sense of intentionality. But I have to be flexible in what that means and allow for what comes up in the day to come up. So I feel like I've gotten better with being more flexible and allowing for more grace. Because some days are just hard and you're just like, you know what, I'm just going to go to sleep. And tomorrow we'll start over and see what happens.
That resonates. And the word for me that's coming up is surrender. Like for me, this period has been a lesson in just surrendering to not being able to do what we want or feeling how we feel and just leaning into it rather than trying to bypass or change it.
Yeah.
So that segues nicely into my favorite question of all. So Layla, who are you beyond your roles?
Oh, never. Why didn't you tell me you were going to ask me?
Because I like to see the cogs turning.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's interesting just how much we are attached to our roles, right? That it's hard to kind of see ourselves outside of that. But what strikes me, though, I think is just how outside of being a mother, a wife, a daughter, a writer, podcaster, right? It's very simple, right? It's very simple who I am. I'm a human being who is on a journey of learning about herself and learning about her world and learning how to love herself and to love her world. And that it's so funny because it's so simple when you strip everything else back, all the things you need to do and be for other people. I'm just someone who loves learning. Like that's the, I've really come to that realization. I'm just someone who has this deep, deep hunger for learning, like learning in and of itself and then learning so that I can grow and I can help, I can change myself and I can help change the world. It's such that's a thread that's always been there for me.
I can see that in how you just show up. What a beautiful answer. I asked that question because the answers are always beautiful. So thank you for going there with me. When did you realize you were Black?
When I was in nursery. I don't remember a specific incident at nursery. I just knew that me and one other girl, I believe, were the only kids who were our color and everybody else was a different color. And sort of feeling like, because you know, at that age, you don't have the same languaging abilities, right? Of to be course. Able to communicate it. But it's more of a feeling of I'm different than them. I was also the only Muslim kid in a Catholic school. So there was that otherness as well, right? So the things that we're talking about at school, like Easter and Christmas and all of these things, we weren't talking about at home, right? And so I was having to go home and my mom's like, no, we are Muslim. And I'm like, no, mom, we have to say grace before we eat, right? And learning all the prayers and the hymns. And I have this tape that my mom took of me when I was 3 years old. My dad worked at sea. He's worked at sea his whole life. And so she would record tapes of us and then post them to him so that he could hear us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I have this one. It's in my car, actually. I play it sometimes. I have an old car that still has a tape.
Vintage. I love it.
It's an old car. And so I'm 3 years old. I'm Welsh. I've got a Welsh accent. But what's amusing is I keep singing this little song to myself and it's Welcome Baby Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom at one point's like, stop singing that. Right? She's trying to get me to do something else. And I'm just there going, Welcome Baby Jesus. So it was this tension because at school I'm being taught we have to do one thing and that we are one thing. And then at home it was something else. So there was always this sense of I'm different than them.
Yeah.
You know, we would go to mass every week and, you know, I wouldn't go up for the communion. You'd listen to the sermon, you know, sing the hymns. But when it was time to go up for communion, everyone would go up except for me.
Yeah.
So that's always been there, the sense of difference. I think the first time that I took it as you're Black and that's not a good thing was, I think I was a little bit older. So maybe around seven years old when, you know, a kid at the park told me, oh, your skin looks like poop, you know. And it's so interesting how it's still very emotional.
Yeah.
Right? Like all these years later, because it was the first moment that I felt this great sense of shame over something that I couldn't change.
Yeah.
And something that was being pointed out that up until that point it didn't seem like a bad thing. It was just, this is brown skin.
Yeah.
But it was so, the boy was so cruel about it. That it stopped me from wanting to go back to this park. And this is a park that was walking distance from our home. We were there all day, especially in the summer. We were there all day long. I remember from that point onwards, I didn't want to go.
Yeah.
And I stayed home. And I remember just feeling like the outside world wasn't safe for me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so exposing. Because, you know, you speak to so many Black people who have similar stories of that. My story was around seven and it was a girl who likened me to poo-poo. But it's so exposing and the shame, the burning shame. It sticks because of that.
And it's hard to verbalize it because, like I said, up until that point, like I knew I was different, but I didn't necessarily see it as something that was dirty or bad, right?
Yeah.
And in that moment, when you're called something like that, and it's your skin, like there's nothing you can do to change it, and you don't necessarily feel ashamed of it. I never at any point in my life felt like, oh, I wish I was white. Like that was never a thought that I had. I think I just wanted to be quote unquote normal in dominant culture.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't want to be anything other than what I was, but I didn't want what I was to be seen as bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that as a child, it's not something that you have any
language
control over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Thank you for sharing that. Do you remember if you shared what happened with your parents?
I didn't actually. And I remember, so my, like I said, my dad worked at sea a lot. So my mom raised us alone a lot. But I just felt such shame that I didn't bring it up to her because I felt like this shouldn't, it was like feeling like this shouldn't upset me the way it's upsetting me. And if I tell her, maybe she's just going to be like, just ignore it or, you know, don't worry about it. So I didn't bring it up with her. But funnily enough, around that same age, she had a conversation with me about race and gender, right? So she was brushing my hair one day and was like, you know, because you're Black and Muslim and a girl, the world is going to treat you differently. Like these three things are going to work against you. So you have to work three times harder than your friends and everyone around you to be treated the same. And again, I felt that same feeling of like, first I was like, no, that can't be true, right? What are you talking about, right? People don't see me differently. Like my teachers don't see me differently.
Yeah.
My friends don't see me like that. And she was like, it's hard for you to understand now, but you'll understand when you're older. And I felt angry at her. Like, why would you tell me this? You know, and again, I can't control it. And I also felt this sense of like, you'll see, I'm going to prove you wrong.
Yeah.
And so my heart goes out to her now. She was an immigrant, right? So I'm a first generation British citizen. She was an immigrant. She moved to the UK in the 70s, experienced all kinds of racism herself, and was raising us pretty much alone because my dad worked away so much as a Black Muslim woman, knowing how her children are being perceived by, you know, by dominant culture, by society.
Yeah.
So it was really hard for her. And I really only understand that now as an adult and as a parent.
Yeah.
But back then I was like, why would you say this to me?
Yeah.
Why are you saying this? This isn't true. But it was true.
Of course.
And it is true.
Yeah. And it remains true, sadly. I think we touched upon something similar when you interviewed me for your podcast with my dad, when he was having these conversations to an extent with me. And I'd be like, oh, come on, Dad. You know, that was a long time ago. And then you're like, I'm going to eat my words.
Right.
But there is, you know, understandably, there's this fierce resistance because cognitively it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. And it's hard. I mean, and I know as a parent, so my kids are 11 and 6.
Mm.
And I've had to be having those conversations with my kids, even though we don't live in a dominantly white society.
Yeah.
We live in a very multicultural society. But I need them to understand these things.
Yeah.
As Black children who will grow into Black adults, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, the questions they ask me, they want to understand why. Like, it doesn't make sense to them. And I'm like, I know, it doesn't make sense. It's wrong, is what it is, right? And with my daughter, she's the elder one. So she has, because we've been having these conversations longer, so she is able to understand it on a different level.
Yeah.
But with my son, who's 6, I mean, first of all, he's like, how do we know that we're Black? Right? Because when we use these words, when we say Black, we know what we mean. But
of course,
he's like, it's not the color Black.
Absolutely. Like, none of it makes any sense. Like, it just, to children, it's actually so simple.
Right.
Like, what is going on with these adults?
Right. Right. Exactly. And he's in a class where, you know, and both my kids are in these classes where there's kids from all backgrounds, right? And so today we were just having a conversation. He was asking me about someone who is Filipina, so she's Asian. And that was a new term for them, right?
Yes.
And for him especially. So he said, is she Black or is she white? And I said, she's neither. Mm. She's Asian. She is, I guess you could say, a person of color, right? Which is, again, a new term for them.
Yeah.
Like, what does this mean? But I remember having, I think it was last year, I was having a conversation with my daughter, and I pointed out to her the fact that while she was in a class where there were many people of different races, actually she's the only Black girl in her class.
Yes.
And that was a revelation for her, because she didn't see herself as different in that regard. A lot of her friends are Asian, Arabs.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, and Muslim as well. Right, many, not all, but many Muslim kids there. So she's like, we're the same in that way. And I'm like, yes. And you're the only Black kid in your class.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, right. So this other layer. So having to, sometimes I wonder, right, like, what is the right thing to say, right, to help them to understand about race and racism? Because we only want to teach it to them so that they understand racism.
Absolutely.
Not so that they understand race as these absolute constructs, because we know that race is a social construct.
Yeah.
It's not a biological fact.
Yeah.
But in order for them to understand racism,
they need to
understand the construct of race.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you think, oh, wouldn't it be easier if we just, you know, didn't say all of these things? But the fact of the matter is, they would make up their own
conclusions.
Understandings, right, of why the world is the way it is. And the conclusions might probably be that they are inferior.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so we have to point out from the very beginning, this is a construct that exists out in the world and it's not true.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fiercely hold that as not true. So important. And it's a question I get a lot, and we'll talk about your young readers edition as well in anti-racism. Do we have these conversations with children or not? And it's exactly what you say. Whether or not we are having these conversations, they're learning it from what we don't say, nonverbal cues, how they're seeing who's valued in society differently. So, you know, get on top of it, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you said, I mean, you asked me at the beginning, like, when did you first know that you were Black? And it was so early on for me. So we can't not have these conversations with kids, because they're already noticing it from a very early age, much earlier than we think they are.
Yeah.
right? Yeah. And they're starting to draw certain conclusions or certain reasons why things are the way that they are. And if we're not intentional about pointing out, like making the oxygen that we're breathing in clear to them, right?
Yes.
So that they can see it, they will internalize certain ideas
absolutely
about themselves and about the world that are just not true and that absolutely are harmful.
And that's how we reproduce racism and exactly have been for so long. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I know some of the answer to this, but can you talk about what led you to, because I discovered you on Instagram, it would have been towards the end of 2017 after Charlottesville, mm-hmm, and somebody had shared the letter you wrote to spiritual white women. I think it was at the end of 2017.
Yeah, I wrote it in August of that year.
Right on top of Charlottesville. And then your Me and White Supremacy Instagram challenge that followed. Yeah. My question to you is, what on earth possessed you to do that?
Well, I think it's probably similar to the answer that you would give why the hell would you do this work?
I know.
When you know everything it takes from you. There is no, it's not a rational, intentional, conscious choice you make at the beginning.
Yeah.
At the beginning, it's something that something happens.
Yeah.
Whether to you or collectively, right? So it's either a personal experience that happened to you or something that you're seeing out in the world, which is what it was for me. That was built up of all of these years, of all of these experiences and observations, right? But this, for me, it was this event in Charlottesville, this rally that it's hard even like talking about it because I remember is seeing the absolute hatred, in these predominantly white men's eyes. Who were marching in Charlottesville and having this moment of connecting it very directly to all the experiences that I had had throughout my life and viscerally seeing it. Because I think prior to that, it was this like ethereal thing that you couldn't quite touch or see. It's very subconscious. It's happening on this sort of, that microaggression layer. Yeah. Right, that you can't necessarily point to, but here was pure hatred. And the only time I'd ever seen anything like that was studying in history class and studying about, the Nazis, right? Mm. And thinking, gosh, like how did that happen? How were there people like this who had these beliefs? But that was in the past and it's not now. And it's like, no, this is right now.
Yeah.
This is a clear and present danger. And it is directed towards you and people who look like you, people you love, right? And people who are connected to you. And so that was what brought me into writing that letter. But that, it wasn't like, I'm going to write this letter and then I'm going to, from here on out, right? Talk about white supremacy and anti-racism. Because I was doing spiritual life coaching work before that, right? And that wasn't my field. But I was very abruptly inundated, right? Like in what's the word where you're like brought in to this work. And I tried in various ways many times to push it away from myself. Because it would come in these moments of launch, write this article or launch this Instagram challenge. But it was always, I'm going to do this and then that's it.
Yeah.
And if you remember, after I did the Instagram challenge, I published the workbook that was Me and White Supremacy before it was the book. And part of the reason why I published it for free was me saying, I don't want to continue with this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to put this out into the world and this is not a career for me. Like, this is not what I'm doing. This is not what I'm committing to. I've done my part. It was like, God, you asked me to do this.
I've done it. Now leave me be.
Right? Let me go back to being me. And it was like, who is that me anymore? I don't even know who she is. And I don't know that I want to be her, because she was so unaware of what is going on. And I think these various moments of pushing it away and then being given signs that, no, look what this is doing in the world. Look at how this is changing people's lives. Kept bringing me back to it again and again, until at a certain point, then it became a conscious choice. Yes. Okay. I hear you. You are calling me to this work. I have tried to turn away from it. You keep bringing it back to me. There must be a reason for that. And the thing is, Nova, as hard as this work is, and we know how hard it is to be Black women with fierce voices who are talking about things that people don't want to hear about, that really rattle the status quo of these systemic oppressions. Like, it's so hard. And yet, throughout all of my life and all of the many different things that I've tried to do in my life as different careers, nothing has felt as true as what I do.
Yeah.
Like, I will suffer for it.
Yeah.
Because it is the thing that I'm here to do.
Yeah.
And that is like, I remember doing life coaching and being like, this wears me out. Like, I can't do one. Do you know what I mean? Like,
just being scratch the surface.
Right. Of being relieved when like a client would cancel or something. I'm like, that's not normal, right? Like that. That is not normal.
I'm laughing because I used to coach as well. And I would have similar, just absolutely. It's a very weird dance, isn't it? It's some of the, it is the hardest work I've ever done and the most violent work I've ever done. And it's also the most enriching and transformative. And it's the most healing work I've ever done.
Healing work. And I think that's the surprising part, that from something that is so violent and so harmful and so heartbreaking, that healing can happen as a through it. Yeah. The work that I put out into the world, I internalize it as well. And I ask myself, how is white supremacy present in my life? How are these systems of oppression present in my life? And what have I taken in and accepted as fact that isn't fact?
Yes.
And how has that influenced what I think of myself and what I think of other people? And what healing work do I need to do around that? So it's the most, I feel like it's the most rigorous, training program for healing and transformation that I've ever been in. And I've, for a very long time, been invested in, self-help and personal growth. What has been missing has been this component for me, which is systems of oppression. How has that, not just with, a mindset of lack or a mindset of sabotage, that or a mindset of imposter syndrome, where does all that come from?
Absolutely.
And connecting those dots, that for me, I mean, imposter syndrome was a big one for me.
Yep.
Right. So connecting the dots that for me, when I talk about imposter syndrome and when a white woman talks about imposter syndrome, we may be talking about similar ways that it shows up.
Yep.
But the roots of it
are different.
Are different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that has been very validating and very healing for me.
Yeah. It's, I mean, just what you were saying about, the work that you're putting out into the world, you're also doing it for and on yourself. And I honestly don't think that anybody who's claiming to be anti-racist, you cannot do this work in its essence properly without self-interrogating. You can't. And anyone who says that you can is bypassing it. Because it's getting it cognitively is the easy part.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's easy for us to try and stay at that level.
Yes.
Because it's safe and it's there's nothing that has to be risked or changed. Right. But for me, I think of again, like that little Layla and all the things that she believed about herself that just weren't true.
Yeah.
Right. And that she deserves that healing and my children also. So yeah. I'm trying to figure this out for myself so I can give them better lessons than the ones that I received from society.
Yeah.
And it's, again, it's like, it's not a job where I see it as that's my job and then there's the rest of my life.
Mm.
And that's why it was so hard when you asked me that question, right? Of like, who are you
outside of
identities? Because it was like, this is so much more than something that I do separately. It's part of the journey that I'm on as a human being in this lifetime. Absolutely. Is learning these lessons and unlearning these lessons and passing on something different to my children and hopefully future descendants, right? Like it's so deep.
Yeah,
it's
is.
Just so very deep, yeah.
And we don't necessarily have conscious awareness of how deep it is working on the subconscious as well. So this stuff, if it's done properly, I believe will have a generational impact. So, yeah.
And you know what as well, Nova? Like, I feel like understanding that these isms have been in place for centuries.
Yes.
And so we are undoing the work of centuries has actually given me a lot more grace and self-compassion.
Yeah.
When I find myself once again facing, right, this belief about myself or this pattern of behavior. And it's like, I thought I dealt with that, you know?
Yeah.
Like I thought like I understood it and it's gone away. And it's like, no, like you're literally like sloughing off these layers of centuries of internalized oppression. So it will come up again and again and again. And you have to have a lot of self-compassion around it for yourself. Because just because you get it cognitively doesn't mean that it's gone through all of the layers. And many of them are spiritual, like
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, the body remembers. The self-compassion piece is so huge for me. And I think something that I found quite helpful when I get back into, you know, I should know better, because also I've trained in therapy as well. Like I know all the tools. And then I end up down this spiral or this shame spiral or self-hate or whatever way it manifests. Because nobody can beat me up in the way that I beat myself up.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what I've learned and I'm finding helpful is that this is remembering that I'm experiencing this because this is a symptom of suffering. This is a symptom of trauma.
Yeah.
And holding that in mind helps me get back to a state where, okay, self-compassion, and let me just notice it.
Yeah.
And then I can move on rather than go down this rumination and this unhealthy spiral. So,
Yeah. And I mean, we are two people who are doing anti-racist education work, right? And that doesn't mean that we have moved past these things, right? Like we're living them every single day. And in fact, we're very conscious of them. So we can sometimes be harder on ourselves, right? Like, why am I thinking that? Why am I believing that? I know better than that, right? It's like, yeah, but it's not about just knowing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's embodying it and being it. And it's a journey and it's ongoing.
Yes.
So in developing the Instagram challenge and then the workbook and then the book that we all, well, the book is that it's now a New York Times best-selling book. How, there's a few questions in here. How did it feel to become a New York Times best-selling author? And what are some of the most humbling responses you've had to your book being out in the world?
One of the things that I'm really glad about is that the book became an instant New York Times bestseller. So in the week that it was published, it was a bestseller. And the reason why I say I'm grateful is because that was in February.
Yes.
And then we had a resurgence of sales in the summer of 2020 because of the Black Lives Matter protests.
Yeah.
And that's when a lot more people became familiar with my work. And I think, so that big resurgence in the summer was very discombobulating.
Yes. Yeah, that's the word.
Right. I have a lot of different feelings around that. And I think if in that time that my book, if my book had been published at that time and became a bestseller in that time because of what was happening as a result of the murder of George Floyd, I would have even more conflicting feelings about it than I do now. So I'm grateful that it happened outside of that. And it happened because it was an instant New York Times bestseller at the time because of the people who had already been engaged in the work over time.
Mm.
Right. So we had a really great pre-order campaign.
Lovely.
And because people were familiar with the work. Right. And so when we did get the news, I mean, it was one of the happiest days of my life. Like I was away from family, but I was with two of my closest friends in New York and in Chicago. And one lives there in Chicago and one had come from Canada to be with me.
Oh.
And we were doing an event, right? So it was like this, and we finished the event and we went back to the hotel and had a celebratory dinner. And it was amazing. Like it was amazing. I called everyone. I called, you know, all my family, obviously, but also my friends, and was like, we did this, like you are there supporting me and this is a win for us. And so it was this incredible moment. I have different feelings, I think, about it from when it resurged again in the summer because of the context of why it did resurge. The way that I came to peace with it was recognizing that yes, this heinous thing has happened and it continues to happen. But this is how I'm contributing to healing in some way.
Absolutely.
And so this book is meeting the people who are ready to begin confronting it.
Mm.
Right? So you kind of have to like separate yourself from this process because it's not like writing a book that is, let's say, a novel or something that isn't about these very pressing problems that pertain to your own identity and pertain to, you know, violence in the world.
Yeah.
Right. Like if it was a self-help book, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was about, I don't know, creativity or courage or hope or self-compassion or something other than this, you know, I wouldn't have any conflicting feelings.
Yeah. Because there's separation.
Absolute separation. But with this, that isn't there. And so it's always going to be complicated. And I know Rennie Edelodge, when she became number one Sunday Times bestseller, right? The first Black author, I think, not just Black woman. I believe it was Black author to become number one. Like she shared her own conflicting feelings around that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I so get it. People expect you to be like grateful. And you're like, oh,
no,
like it's so layered. It's so, so layered. And all of those feelings are there. Of course, you're grateful. You poured yourself into this work, but you know why it's happened. And you don't like that.
That doesn't feel good. It was, I had a similar thought process when I got my book deal. So I got a book deal. First offer was in April and the second offer was either end of April or beginning of May. And I remember when, you know, the Black Lives Matter process happened and George Floyd had died, and there was this exponential increase in interest in my business. And then I think we moved the announcement of the book deal forward. We expedited the press release as a result of what was going on in the world. And I remember thinking that how would I think that would have had a huge knock on my trust in myself and my work and my ability if I'd been given a book deal off the back of this murder,
right.
Which, as we know, there's been a whole surge of anti-racism books that have been churned out as a result of that. And I don't know how I would feel.
Right. So those books are necessary and important, and we need different authors and teachers speaking to different people at different levels. But you're absolutely right. It's like, you know, we both saw, and many of our peers also saw this, like a massive increase in our social platforms.
Yeah.
As a result of this. And again, like for me, it caused me to withdraw. I was like, I'm out. Like, This is too much.
I'm tapping out. It was so overwhelming. But all of these layers and what was really interesting to me was this article I read. I think it was you that shared it with me, Layla, where they were looking at the patterns of
books,
civil rights. It was about books and the patterns of like civil rights crisis happening, and then the surge of black books and black talent and anti-racism books, and then you trace it back throughout history. And I'm like, that's what I find troubling, that there's this surge of interest and then it just peters off again.
Right.
Whereas actually, it should be continuous, not just when we have these huge human rights crisis.
And I think what's frustrating is it's almost like we're seen as being discovered at those times, even though we've always been there.
Yes.
We're doing the work consistently, always, whether regardless of what's happening out in the world, we're doing the work. But it's only taken seriously or only momentarily having the spotlight shone on us during that time period. And anyway, I mean, I could go on and on about it. And there's many things that I feel very strongly about.
Yes.
But I think it's, I guess what I want anyone who's listening to hear is that, first of all, we're very aware of these patterns.
Yes.
Right. I don't think that the people who are engaging in it are necessarily aware, but we are
Agreed. Yeah.
And that it does result a lot of times in a feeling of distrust.
Yes.
And cynicism.
Yeah.
Which I had to really fight last year. I had to fight cynicism and come to a sense of hope. And my word for this year is hope, because of how low I hit last year.
Yeah.
As a result of all of the things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I had to come back to, I can't allow the energy with which I approach this work to be dictated by how white people are responding to it.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, hope for me is something that is a practice, is something that I have to really invest in and keep consistent, not because I hope white people will get it and I'm waiting for them to get it en masse, but because this is the one thing, I think, generation after generation of people who have done this work, whether they've done it as like, they are activists or they have done it in everyday small ways in their own lives. One of the things I think they have held onto is that there is a hope of a better world. It's possible.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's what I cling to. But you had asked me also about like, what was some of the most touching things?
Yes.
As a result, you know, the most touching things for me are always like the emails that we get of people who are like, we're doing, like, I'm 70 years old and we're doing this in our, like, you know, parish group, or, you know, I work for a nonprofit and I brought this into the workplace and they've made it like mandatory for onboarding new employees, or things like that, where it's not this big fanfare. It's not this big, like, splashy thing across a magazine, but it's the way the work has actually been, is being internalized and taken on board. And one of the stories as well that really stays with me, which was pre the book coming out, I think it was in the workbook time, we got an email from a woman who was co-parenting their child with their like divorced ex who was white. So the woman, I believe, was black, or a woman of color. The husband's white, so the kid is biracial. And for years, I think she'd been trying to explain to their co-partner, like, co-parent, like, about racism and how we have to raise our child with this awareness, and they didn't get it. And so they gave them the workbook and they worked through it, and it's completely changed how they co-parent this
Amazing.
Child. And that made me cry. That was like, that's not a company. It's not a whole group of people. It's two people raising a child.
Yeah.
And that was so beautiful to me.
Yeah. Because that's where change happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or the most profound change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Layla. Mm. You touched upon it a little. Can we talk about boundaries? Because, Layla, you are queen of boundaries.
I love talking about boundaries, Nova.
I thought I did boundaries well until I met Layla, and Layla is queen of boundaries. And can you just talk me through, I mean, just talk to me about boundaries, how you have had to learn to enforce them to support your well-being, especially whilst you're in this space.
Yeah, so I think there's sort of, in understanding like how I approach boundaries, I feel like there's two things that are important to understand. First is that I am very much an individualistic person. Like, you can't tell me what I can and cannot do. Right. So I don't have people pleasing tendencies. I definitely had like good girl tendencies, and that was a construct that I was raised within. But if I have to choose between what makes someone else happy and what makes me happy, like, I'm going to choose what makes me happy.
Okay.
And that's just a part of who I am. The other part is understanding a lesson that my dad taught us when we were really, really young, which was, you teach people how to treat you.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember him saying it that often, but I remember him saying it, and it just stuck with me, you know, like, you have to set the expectations. Mm-hmm. So you have to be really clear with people about what is and isn't okay with you, because if you just leave it to chance, they will treat you how they want to treat you.
Yes.
Right. So that's always been there. And I think also what I get from my mom is, my mom's a very direct person. My mom and dad are so different. It's so funny. Yeah. She's fire. He's kind of like, not ice, but I would say he's kind of like air, right? He's like, they're very, very different. But she's a very direct person, and she's the kind of person that, because she's so upfront and direct with who she is, you know from the get-go if this is my kind of person or not.
Mm.
And she likes to be clear from the outset. So I get a lot of that from her as well. And I believe that when we are transparent with people, we give people the opportunity to make a choice for themselves, right?
Absolutely.
About what they are okay with or not. But if we're not, then there can be a lot of miscommunication that can happen, and resentment that can build up that just wasn't necessary if we had just been clear from the outset.
Yeah.
But what made all of this stronger for me, or more of a more intentional practice, was doing this work, was doing the work of talking to white people around race and white supremacy, and receiving, you know, tidal waves of white fragility.
Yes.
That shows up in all kinds of ways. And for me, and I'm sure you would say for you, for me, the most harmful ways that shows up isn't even the like most obvious racism,
no.
Right? Like the very overt racism, because that's just like, oh, okay, you're just an outright racist.
I'm going to avoid you. Yeah. For me, there's also an element of respect, might be the wrong word, but there's an element of I respect that you're being truthful about who you are, and that there's no lies. I know where I stand with you.
Right. But it's the other type, right? That is from people who say, I've always supported your work, but da 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 da. Right?
Yes, but people.
Right. If you would only do da-da-da, then we would be more likely to, you know, support you, believe you, be a part of this, right? That way that it shows up, and it's like, what do I do with this, right?
Mm.
And so I had to, because it wears and tears. And I know you've done a TED Talk on microaggressions, which if anyone hasn't seen it, they should go watch it.
Thanks, Lena.
But, you know, it wears and tears at you, and it makes you feel like you're losing your mind, right? It's the it's the gaslighting.
Yeah.
And so because I'm one person who, because of a viral article, suddenly had many, many people all wanting different things from me, having different expectations of me, by force, I had to learn how to have stronger boundaries, by force, to save myself.
Yeah.
How I enforce those boundaries has changed over time.
Mm.
Because at the beginning, it was very much if I don't put up very strong, very clear boundaries right now, they are going to inundate me, and it kind of felt like I would be destroyed, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel I was still working through a lot. I think a lot of understanding my own internalized oppression.
Yeah.
So boundaries were very much like walls. Stay out. Like, unless you're this, that, you can't come inside here. So it was more coming from a place of fear of them, right? And I think over time it's evolved to love of me.
100% understand. Different. It's very different.
It's very different. And I think one of the biggest difference around the boundaries for me is boundaries, my own boundaries of myself, of how I will act or not act.
Yes. And being a choice.
So it's not just about when someone does this, I'm going to do that. It's when this situation shows up, I am not going to respond in these ways, because that would be me violating my own boundaries.
Yes.
And inviting in all the things that I say I don't want.
Yeah.
Right. So it becomes more about like how you hold yourself rather than what you're trying to protect yourself from.
Yes.
And then it becomes very clear to me. So if something arises, where I'm like, this is either a boundary has been violated or there is a potential for boundary to be violated. Mm. I already have for myself, like, what things do I need in place? Do I know that I need in place for me to feel safe and protected and honored? Are they in place? If not, I need to communicate them.
Yep.
Right. And I don't need to do it in a cruel way, right? I don't need to like be, aggressive about it. It's just, this is what it is.
Yeah.
This is, in order for me to feel safe and protected and honored, this is what I need in place.
Absolutely.
Right. And if that's not possible, then this is where our journey ends.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very clear. And I think sometimes we're afraid of doing that because we, especially as Black women, but Black Indigenous people of color, we are given so little.
Mm.
And because of that, when we're given an opportunity, we're afraid to do anything that may rock the boat.
Yep.
Right? Or give others a reason to take the thing away from us that they've given us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we really have to know, like, no, I'm the source.
Mm.
I'm the source that they're trying to tap into.
Yeah.
Right? They're not the source. They're not giving me anything.
Yeah.
Right? This is me, first of all, and this is regardless of if you are doing the kind of work that Nova and I do, like, your being in the world is a gift to all of us.
Absolutely.
And anyone who is around you is benefits from your presence there.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's important for you to recognize that within yourself. And once you begin to recognize that within yourself, and that involves doing all of that healing work that we've talked about, to really believe it.
Yep.
To really, really believe it, like it is the absolute truth. Then holding boundaries is a natural, it's just a natural extension of that.
Yeah. Rather than attaching to it and making meaning out of what it means if I hold this boundary, or I'm saying no, or this might mean I'm a bad person or aggressive or whatever it might be. Like, this is how I keep myself safe. And
this is how I'm at my best.
And that's right? It. And when you're able to function, when these boundaries are in place, just how you show up is more powerful, more human, more honest. And we need more of that. I hope you've been taking notes. That was a masterclass, a very fast masterclass in boundaries. Layla, I've got two more questions. I really am mindful of your time. I wish I could
talk to you
forever.
You know that.
Thank you. Can we talk a little bit about Me and White Supremacy Young Readers Edition and your book club?
So the Young Readers Edition of Me and White Supremacy is something that I'm working on. And I'm going to be really honest. Like, it is... it's challenging me.
Yeah.
It's challenging me. And at first I thought it was because it's a children's book and I'm not a children's writer.
Mm.
Even though I have children, but I don't write for children, right?
Whole different entity.
Very different. Then the pandemic hit and that threw everything, you know. But there is this real energy around it that's big for me. And it's I think it's the weight of the responsibility.
Oh, yes.
of speaking to children about race. Definitely had certain points where, so there's a, it's different to the adult version in that it's for children of all races, which means it has to be written in a different way.
Yeah.
It's still an interactive book. It's still a book that you engage with, but it's written for all kids. So it, first of all, it was technically, how do we do this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was, oh, okay. As adults, we understand that what race and what racism is and why it exists. Kids don't. They don't understand the context of it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of explaining first that I had to do, sort of history 101. Mm. Digging into that history so that I could understand it as an adult and then translate it so a child could understand it was one of the most painful things that I did last year.
Oh, yeah.
Because, at some point I had to stop reading about colonialism.
Violence. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. At some point it was just, I can't do this anymore because it is so violent.
Yeah.
What happened all around the world.
Yeah. On black bodies.
Uh-huh. On black and brown bodies, indigenous bodies, and the way it's still connected today, right, to violence that is happening. But I knew that without that context, the rest just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right? So that was a big piece for me. I think it's the weight of the responsibility of speaking to young people. It's knowing that it's one thing to raise my own kids, right? and to be able to really nurture how they are, like receiving it and support them in that way. But with everything I write in this book, I'm constantly having to think, how will this child hear this?
Yeah.
What will they internalize about themselves about it?
Yeah.
Or about how will this change how they interact with their friends?
Yeah.
Or the way they feel about themselves or the conversations they're going to have with the adults in their lives.
Yeah.
What if the adults in their lives don't know how to make space for these conversations for them?
Yeah.
So it is hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. I do believe that, you know, it's taking the time that it needs to take for it to be what it needs to be and for me to be where I need to be when it comes out in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but it is one of those things at the moment where I'm like, can I just like do this, right? And just move on. Like, I just want to be done with it and move on.
I know that feeling.
Right? You know it, right? But it's like, no, like I trust myself that it will get done.
Yeah.
That it will get done in the way that it needs to get done, that it will meet kids at the time that they need to read it. But it's, we're living in tough times. Like there's so much flux happening right now that even the way that I there's things that I want to revisit that I'm like, oh, I wrote about that. But actually all of these other things have become relevant in just this year.
Yeah.
That can help connect it in a way where they understand it better.
Yeah.
So that's where I am. It's a labor of love.
That's where I'm at with that. Thank you for sharing that. There's just two points there about the process of the researching that needs to happen to put the work out in the world that we put out. And you know, that's the part that nobody's, like, I don't know about you, Layla, but there was times where I was just wailing, absorbing, reading, processing, and just...
I would find myself just... sitting and start and tears are rolling down.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm like, where is this coming from?
Yes.
What's happening? A lot of it for me was actually, and I think this process is also about for the healing of my own inner child.
Yeah, for sure.
Because a big part of it for me was, I wish I'd known this when I was young. And that inner child in me going, this is just not fair.
Yeah, because it's
and she's right.
Yeah,
it's right?
Absolutely
and
not.
She's right. And all I could do was just sit with her and let her cry and let her rage and let her feel whatever it was that she felt. I think it's so important for like publishers of Black writers to understand this process that we go through and authors of color, that we're not just able to just churn these books out on their schedules because it is so deep.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that. Tell us about your book club. Yeah. And then I've got one more question for you and I'll let you go.
The book club is totally like different energy to what we just talked about. This is something that I've been wanting to do. So Good Ancestor Book Club is what we're talking about. It's something that I've been wanting to do for a really long time. It's interesting. I went to go see if the URL was taken and I was like, oh, someone bought it. Turned out it was me who bought it. I had bought it like a year ago and completely forgotten.
Your past self looking after future self. Right.
Exactly. I had bought goodancestorbookclub.com because I knew this was coming. Books are just like, they're my happy place. They're myself. They're, like I said at the beginning, I'm just someone who loves learning. So they are me being in my element. You know, you can never have too many books. And so I've been sharing, like I often share the books that I'm reading on Instagram and just share with like the hashtag read with Layla, right? But I think it's come to a point where I'm interviewing more and more authors on the podcast. And each time I'm like, I wish we could go even deeper within this book with other people in our community. Because I really believe that in order for change to happen, we need awareness, we need knowledge, we need that understanding that we then couple with action to create change. But when you take action without knowledge and understanding, that's when performativity happens.
Yeah.
And that's where potential harm happens because you don't understand the context that you're dealing within.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to create this book club as a way to, you know, for me to just have an excuse to read more books and talk about them with other people. For me to use my platform even further to celebrate and uplift BIPOC authors and leaders.
Amazing.
And honor their work. I mean, we do that on the podcast already, but the book club is just an extension of that. For us to create real intentional community as well. And I think that's something that a lot of us have been thinking about this year because we have been so social distanced. We have been using social media more, but I think many of us are coming to a realization that that's not necessarily intentional community.
Yes, it's not.
Right? It's not. It's a place where we can keep tabs on what everyone else is doing, right? And follow other people. And even a place where we put other people on pedestals or take them off it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it's not intentional community coming together for a specific purpose.
Yeah.
And in a world where we are fighting these many different crises, there is, I think, a real need for community. Right, there's a real need to not feel alone, to feel like there's something that I can do to contribute to a better world, and my part of that is learning.
Yeah,
right, learning, encouraging each other, inspiring each other, and really supporting and listening to BIPOC leaders who are showing us the way.
Yeah.
So what we're doing in the book club is each month we're choosing a book selection of the month. Our very first one is The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr. Mm. I love it so much. It tells the story of two enslaved men who are in a relationship, but they're on a deep South plantation. Mm. And it is about their love and their experiences together. It is about betrayal, that their love and togetherness is betrayed. It's also about everyone else who is on that plantation with them, including the enslavers and those who are enslaved who each have their own take on this relationship. And their understanding of it. But it's also about ancestors, the people, their own ancestors from Africa and the people who came before them. And it's just this beautiful tale. Robert is a magnificent writer. This is his debut novel.
Wow.
It's very reminiscent of Toni Morrison's writing. And it's just, it's just a narrative that's been missing, right? Because reading stories about, you know, enslavement is very, very hard. And you kind of, you're kind of like, oh, I have to, you know. But this story is so unique. I've never read anything like it. Wow. And what I really love about it, I don't want to share too much because I want people to go buy the book. What I really love about it, and he talked about this in our interview together, was like, slavery is actually not the main story here. Mm. That's the thing that's happening in the background.
Yeah.
The main story here is the people.
Yeah.
And their lives. And although you do get to hear the perspective of the a couple of the white characters, it's really the black characters who shine here.
Amazing.
And it's just incredible. So we are, that's our March selection. And in the book club, we are discussing the book. We'll be discussing the book throughout March. And we have an author event at the end of the month with Robert. So our book club members get to ask their questions of him as well, which is just like, yes. And he's so fascinating. But we're excited to do that each month with a different author. And our intention is to feature books and authors who are diverse in terms of where they come from around the world, what their backgrounds are, and what types of books they are writing.
Yeah.
Because, yes, okay, I know a lot of people who are following me and in my work are really wanting to read a lot of anti-racist education books.
Yes.
Those are not the only books that you should be reading.
Absolutely not.
And books that are about you know, books that are, I don't know, science fiction or romance or comedy or science or whatever, they're all important to this conversation. And that's what we're wanting to really highlight here. So it's like the podcast for me, like Good Ancestor Podcast, it's another avenue that I'm like, oh, I can't believe I get to do this work.
Oh, it sounds amazing. And just such a natural add on to what you're already doing. So I can't wait to dive into that. Glorious. and my last question for you today, Layla, is what brings you hope?
Mm. And hope is my word of the year. Mm. Hope. What brings me hope is the work that we can do. Like, what can we do? Right? Hope isn't something that we wait for to be given to us. Hope is something that we actually practice. It's something that we create. It's something that we intend. And so every day, I mean, I have a practice of like reviewing every day. Like I sit down and review my day every day and plan for the day ahead. And then I review at the end of the week and plan for the week ahead. And then I also review at the end of the month. So okay. This weekend, we're recording this last week of February.
Yeah.
And so this is my planning weekend is coming up. And that's when I look at the whole month and I look at like, you know, the things that I intended for this month. Like, did I do them? How were they? What showed up unexpectedly, right? That was really surprising, but amazing that I want to take forward into the next month. And how can I intentionally be a creator of hope, right? And that is, for me, that's what I pour my energy into.
Yeah.
Things like the book club, things like the podcast, things like the writing. Those are spaces in which I'm saying, I want these things to outlive me and always be a source of hope, even when I'm not here.
Yeah.
Right? We talk about very hard things, very violent things, right? Very harmful things, but always with this energy of we want people to leave those conversations or those books with this, with a feeling of, okay, this is the reality of the situation, but I can do something about it.
Absolutely. Oh.
Yeah.
I have goosebumps. Layla, please let everyone listening know where they can find you and follow your work.
Yeah, you can find me. So my website is laylafsad.com. I'm also Layla F. Saad on Instagram, which is the only social media platform that I use. You can find us on Patreon, which is where you'll also find the book club and things to do with the podcast. And that's Good Ancestor Podcast on Patreon. And, you know, on Instagram, we're also Good Ancestor Podcast and Good Ancestor Book Club as well.
And Layla has a book, Me and White Supremacy.
Oh, yeah.
That you can also buy. She's a best-selling Times author. Layla, I could talk to you for another 2 hours. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for who you are and all that you do.
Thank you, Nova. I adore you. I'm so glad that we connected last year, right? For the first time. I feel like I've known you a lot longer. And there's some people who you just feel very, very comfortable speaking with. And that's you for sure, for me. I love everything that you do. I love this podcast, everything that you put out into the world. And I cannot wait to read your book.
Thank you. I'll have to see how I can get in your book club. But yeah, thank you, Layla. I'm blessed to have met you. Thank you so much.
Well, beautiful human, I give you Layla F. Saad. There's not much more I can say. I hope you feel nourished by that conversation, and I would invite you to listen to that again and again, and follow Layla's work, and continue to show up and do the work in the world. And just a reflection of what Layla said, which really stuck to me. Your being in the world is a gift to all of us. If this episode has resonated with you, please do hop on over to your podcast host and leave a review. And as ever, please connect with both Layla and I on social media and let us know what you think. Thank you for sharing this corner of the internet with me. Until next time, see you soon.